Iron Gate, Timeline 3, August 2020. Rita felt trapped in a bad dream. "This can't be happening" felt like it should be a cliché, not a queasy churning in her stomach as men in unfamiliar uniforms pinioned her hands behind her back and dropped a sack over her head, then frog-marched her out of the room. She was hungry, tired, and frightened by this turn of events. All she could do was cling to what the woman called Thorold had said. "A message for you to take to your handlers." She shuffled, trying to keep her feet under her as they hauled her into an elevator. "As long as the message isn't my dead body," she thought. The cop, Inspector Morgan, had been reasonable, but that's what you'd expect of an interrogator. The art of successful interrogation was all about getting the suspect's trust. She'd been spared violence and torture only because they weren't effective means of extracting useful information. They were tools for intimidation, for making someone, often not the victim, do what you wanted. "They aren't going to torture me because it would serve no purpose," Rita told herself uncertainly as the elevator descended. "These people are professionals." But repeating it didn't help. For all she knew, this was another little motivational scenario, an attempt to convince her to cooperate by handing her a believable lie. The elevator juddered to a stop. She felt fresh air on her face, heard voices. "Whatever you do, don't take the cuffs or hood off until I tell you to. We don't know if she's got a tattoo somewhere." They marched her out to a vehicle, shoved her onto a padded bench seat, then someone climbed in next to her. The engine rattled, and the stink of gasoline made her nose itch. They drove for minutes that felt like hours, before coming to a halt somewhere where the air stank of burning diesel. There was a distant roaring. An airport? She wondered dizzily. They lifted her up a short flight of steps and onto another seat. Someone sat down next to her. "We're going for a short flight," Miss Thorold confided in her right ear, confirming her suspicions. "I hope you don't get airsick." Then someone clamped a pair of ear defenders over her hood, muffling everything. There was more vibration, then a gathering banshee scream and a vibration that set her teeth on edge. It seemed to go on forever, until Rita felt her stomach drop away as they rose straight up. "Must be a chopper." Someone removed the ear defenders and hood. Rita blinked at the dazzling daylight. Without the mufflers, the noise was deafening, far louder than Rita would have expected of a helicopter. She was sitting directly behind the pilots, Miss Thorold to her right. Someone in the seat behind her clamped a headset to her ears. She tried to look round, but the cuffs prevented her from turning. The chopper lurched and began to accelerate forward. As it did so, the noise level dropped, as if some sort of boost motor had shut down. "What?" She cleared her throat. "Where are you taking me?" The entire front of the aircraft was a glass bubble. The view would have been mesmerizing if she hadn't felt as if she was about to throw up. The Thorold woman adjusted her mic, then reached up and flipped a switch. "I don't think anyone can overhear us. Miss Douglas, you are in deep shit, and not just because you're an illegal. Luckily for you, I'm going to throw you a life preserver. I'm even going to ask Jack to take the cuffs off, assuming you won't try to jump out the door 10,000 feet. Rita shook her head. Miss Thorold leaned over the chair back and said something on another channel. A few seconds later, the guard in the seat behind her unlocked her handcuffs. "First, I want you to answer a couple of questions for me." Miss Thorold pulled out a bunch of printed papers. "You told the inspector that you were recruited by the DHS after World Walkers tried to abduct you. I want you to tell me exactly what happened." Rita massaged her wrists and stared. "What?" she swallowed. "I thought you'd know." Thorold looked tense. "Pretend I don't. We've got nearly an hour before this flying scrap heap gets where it's going. You've got plenty of time to tell me everything." Cold realization crystallized in her guts. "I'd flown home to Boston from Seattle," she began, then recounted her story for the second or third time this morning. Eventually, Thorold shook her head. "We didn't do it." Her tone was blunt. "Whoever they were, they used totally the wrong protocol. Amateurs. If we'd wanted you, assuming we even knew who you were, we'd have caught you. You know what I think? It was a set-piece scenario organized to motivate you to say yes when they recruited you. You were probably expected to break away when they parked somewhere, or to call up those friendly DHS people who'd bugged your phone." She snorted. "Idiots." "I suspected something like that," Rita said defensively. "But I didn't have any good alternatives." "You could have phoned us." "What? How?" "Let's see." Miss Thorold put her papers away. Not for the first time, Rita noticed that the woman's hands were shaking. "You're 26. Born in 1994. You're a world walker. They finally figured out how to activate the ability in Byblos, did they?" Rita nodded reluctantly. There didn't seem to be any point in denying it. "That means you're a relative. We can confirm it if you like, but at a guess. Indian father, right?" Rita looked away. "I never met my birth parents," she said. "They gave me up for adoption right after I was born. Who are you, and where are you taking me, ma'am? And what have my birth parents got to do with anything?" "Those are three very good questions. You might also want to add, why did your colonel send you in particular?" Thorold sounded approving, as if she wanted Rita to ask questions. Her skin crawled. Asking questions in a classified security perimeter was a good way to get yourself a one-way trip to a jail cell. Even thinking the wrong questions could be dangerous. "I changed my mind. I don't want to know. Tough kid. I'm going to give you more answers than you want. Firstly," Thorold held up a finger, "the clan of world walkers that the U.S. government is so pants-wettingly scared of doesn't exist anymore. We are citizens of the new American Commonwealth, naturalized immigrants, and we mostly work for the government. In my case, I work for an agency called the Department of Parahistorical Research. As you probably guessed, my speciality is paratime security. You could say I'm your Colonel Smith's opposite number. Right now, we're en route to the DPR headquarters in New London. That's the Commonwealth capital, although you know it better as Manhattan. When we get there, you're going to meet my boss. She's a party commissioner, a member of the Central Committee. There is no exact equivalent in the U.S. government, but she is responsible for an entire government ministry, and she's going to give you a message to take home to your bosses." "A message?" Rita felt a stab of hope. "Yes. Don't you think it's better if our political leaders start talking to each other?" Thorold's cheek twitched. "Talking like responsible adults? Instead of shooting down drones and playing stupid Cold War spy games? They should be exchanging embassies, sending diplomats, that sort of thing. This playing footsie with spies, somebody could get hurt." "You want me to be a messenger?" "Yes." Thorold raised her finger again. "But let me warn you what I'm talking about. Your boss couldn't have picked a worse time to play head games with us. The Commonwealth is on a hair trigger. That's because in this world we're one of two superpowers who are pointing lots of nuclear weapons at each other. Our enemy is a totalitarian regime that covers the whole of Europe, Asia, the Middle East, most of Africa, and they'd love to take advantage of any internal crisis to damage the Commonwealth. There are lots of proxy wars on the fringe, and everyone's afraid the big one will start by accident if someone sneezes at the wrong time. Just like the Cold War you might have learned about in history lessons. I'm telling you this because it's possible the Commissioner will be too distracted to mention it, and if she does mention it, you'll probably be too distracted to remember. But it's vitally important that your bosses get the message. The last high-altitude drone they sent over nearly triggered a nuclear war. If that happens again, the consequences will be very bad for everyone. Rita's stomach clenched. You're soft-soaping me. Why? What are you softening me up for? Thorold muttered under her breath. Lightning child. There's no easy way to say this. Rita, Miss Douglas, I am not certain of this. I won't be until the results come back from running the DNA sample the police took from you, and that's going to take a while. But you're the right age, ethnicity, and background, and everything else about you fits. Outside the glass bubble of the helicopter, the world rolled by. Rita's sense of unreality intensified as Miss Thorold continued. The woman you are about to meet is almost certainly your mother. She's known of your existence for about an hour. You are her only child, and I believe you were recruited, trained, and sent here to fuck with her head. Airborne. En route to New London. Timeline 3. August 2020. Miss Thorold clearly had some idea of the impact her words would have on Rita, for she fell silent for the next 10 minutes. This suited Rita completely. She was shaking. Her hands felt cold. She raised them to cover her mouth. Mother meant Emily, not some stranger in a foreign government ministry, not the woman who had turned her back on her as a baby. The realization that she was going to have to meet her made Rita feel increasingly resentful, angry even. Many little girls went through a phase of thinking they were different, of playing make-believe that they'd been left with foster parents, but that when their real parents found them, they'd discover that they were actually a princess. Rita had known better from an early age. Just by looking in the mirror, she could see that she didn't resemble her parents. They hadn't bothered pretending otherwise. They wanted her regardless, and had showered her with love. Rita hadn't ever searched for Cinderella shoes to wear because she'd grown up knowing that she was a pale brown Snow White. Her make-believe queen had betrayed her, abandoning her for good. And now she found herself sitting in the middle seat of a military helicopter, thundering through the skies, to answer the evil queen's summons. When she could trust herself to speak, Rita lowered her hands. Tell me about my... about who I'm going to meet. Miss Thorold's lips thinned. Mrs. Burgesson, Miriam Burgesson, is the party commissioner in charge of the Ministry of Intertemporal Technological Intelligence. If you think of it as a cross between the National Science Foundation, the CIA, and the Department of Transportation, you won't be too far off the mark. Like you, she is a world walker. The Department of Parahistorical Research, where I work, is part of MITI. Her first name was Miriam. Another piece of circumstantial evidence to back up Thorold's assertion, Rita realized. Her birth mother had been called Miriam something or other. She sounds important, is she? You have no idea. Thorold looked away. Her husband runs the Ministry of Propaganda and Communications. They both report in the cabinet to the first man, the equivalent of the president, except he isn't. We have a different constitutional separation of powers. The point is, you are about to have 15 minutes with one of the most important people in the government of this continent, half of the power couple who lead one of our party factions, if you like. She's going to give you a message to take back to your government, along with proof of her identity. and then we're going to get you out of there before the bad guys arrest you. 15 minutes? Rita's voice rose. Yes, it's risky enough as it is. Miss Douglas, Mrs. Burgesson has powerful enemies. Unilaterally opening negotiations with the U.S. government is horribly risky. If it backfires, it potentially gives them grounds to charge her with treason and espionage. You they'd see as leverage, a hostage. But I don't even know her. You know that, I know that, and she knows that. The other side, do not. You will have 15 minutes. Then we'll take you back down to Iron Gate and send you home, along with instructions to contact us safely in future. Above their heads, the engine note began to change. The chopper began to slow. They were flying over buildings, 3 to 6 story blocks. The skyline was unfamiliar to Rita. The southern end of Manhattan in this world boasted no thicket of dense-packed skyscrapers, but an array of neoclassical domes and Gothic cathedrals, and something that looked for all the world like a castle. Well, fuck, Rita thought, staring blankly out through the chopper's bubble nose at the approaching jagged horizon of triumphal arches, palaces, and huge government buildings that eclipsed even the Capitol in D.C. with their bumptious pomposity. I blew the mission, got captured, blabbed when questioned, and now they're just going to run me through an interview with the evil queen, pat me on the head, and send me home. She'd thought she was at rock bottom when the inspector was giving her the third degree, but this was positively mortifying. The chopper slowed, circled, and began to descend toward a lawn that separated 2 marble-fronted wings of a giant palace. Don't try to world walk from here, Miss Thorold advised her. This whole area is built up. You'd break your neck or get run over by a yellow cab. We'll have you home by evening. Rita swallowed. I'll be good, she said hoarsely, unsure whether it was a promise or a threat. Everything now seemed to happen very fast, with the inevitability of a march to a firing squad. The blades spooled down as the chopper settled on its skids and doors opened. The snick of a handcuff around her right wrist locked her to Inspector Morgan, who seemed mildly irritated. They walked to the building, then along endless corridors and a wide marble staircase under stained glass windows. There were flags everywhere, an unfamiliar field of gold stars superimposed on a white circle on a red background. Another corridor, past windows overlooking a broad courtyard and oil paintings of men in wigs, white stockings, and polished steel cuirasses. Then a door, opening as a man's voice said, "Come in." Now they were upstairs. The handcuff was unlocked. Rita found herself in an outer office, desk against one wall, inner office door ajar. "Come on," said Miss Thorold. "George, this is Miss Douglas. We're expected. Please ensure we have privacy." To Rita, "Can you push my chair for me?" "I guess so." Miss Thorold's bodyguard, Jack, gave her a warning look as he surrendered his place to her. "We'll wait here," said Inspector Morgan. "Yes, you will," Miss Thorold pointed. "Rita, that way." Heart in her mouth, Rita pushed the chair forward into the open doorway. "You took your time getting here," said the middle-aged lady behind the desk as she rose to her feet. "Close the—" She stopped and stared. "Olga, is this who I think it is?" "Shut the door, Rita," said Miss Thorold. "Yes, I think so. What's your birthday, Rita?" "May 11th, she said automatically, as the door latched behind her. She couldn't look away from the evil queen. She didn't look particularly evil. She had dark hair and a middle-aged face that had been pretty once, and was now succumbing to gravity's pull. Her costume, no, that's what they wore here, was odd to Rita's eyes, something like a shalwar camise, but tailored and draped with ruffles at collar and cuffs. "Are you my birth mother?" "The DNA results won't be ready for another day," said Miss Thorold. "I don't need them." The commissioner, Mrs. Burgesson, stepped out from behind her desk and slowly approached, staring at Rita. "I spent the 11th of May 1994 in a bed in the obstetrics department at Mass General." Her eyes were very dark, pupils dilated, staring at some inner vista. "And you're a world walker." Rita stepped out from behind Olga's wheelchair. "Yeah, right," she said, crossing her arms defensively. The evil queen looked as if she'd been punched in the gut. "You're not getting to me that easily," Rita thought silently, even though she felt shivery, gripped by a nameless emotion that she wished she could banish. "Miss Thorold here says you've got a message for me."
"Yes, I do,"
Mrs. Burgesson swallowed. For a few seconds she looked as if she was choking, but the moment passed. She turned and walked slowly back behind her desk, as if 10 years had landed on her shoulders in an instant. "Come here and sit down, both of you." Rita wheeled Olga up to the front of the desk, then perched on the edge of a spindly visitor's chair that looked like it belonged in a museum. Mrs. Burgesson, she couldn't help noticing, had a very modern laptop occupying pride of place on her tooled leather desktop, leaving the hulking CRT terminal and its oddly unrecognizable keyboard to sulk in a corner. "Rita," Mrs. Burgesson stopped, then shook her head, as some internal censor brought her tongue up short. "I'm sorry. There's so much to say, and so little time. I wish we had longer."
"Why?"
"So you could explain why you dumped me?" Rita asked, keeping her tone light, even though her words filled her with nausea.
"Don't worry, there's nothing to talk about. I get that you didn't want me. I'm chill. I've got a real family back home who love me anyway."
Miss Thorold glared at her. If looks could kill, Rita would have been incinerated on the spot.
"Why don't we stick to business?" Olga suggested grimly.
Mrs. Burgesson, for her part, looked uncertain. She spoke haltingly.
"Listen, Rita, I know you've little reason to trust me, but it was more complicated than that, and I was younger than you are now. If you ever want to..."
She stopped and dabbed ineffectually at her eyes.
"I'm sorry." She took a deep breath. "Stick to business." Another deep breath. "I want you to take a sealed letter to your boss."
She picked up a plain white envelope, utterly prosaic, that had been sitting on top of an out tray. She pushed it across the desk toward Rita.
"Also this. A plastic screw-top sample tube with a swab in it. Please witness."
Rita watched as the evil queen uncapped the tube, removed the swab, took the end of it into her mouth, then placed it back in the tube and sealed it.
"This will serve to confirm my identity," she said, placing it on top of the letter. She took a deep breath. "Olga, the contact protocol?"
"I don't have it with me. I'll see she has it before she leaves," said Miss Thorold.
She added for Rita's benefit,
"It's a set of times and GPS coordinates you can use to visit this world safely. The locations will be secured at this end, and I'll be available to meet you. No risk of getting run over by streetcars, and no handcuffs."
The evil queen leaned back in her chair, eyes closed, and for a moment, Rita felt a stab of apprehension.
"Last time I spoke to them, they tried to murder me," she remarked to nobody in particular. She opened her eyes and looked at Rita, her face composed and clear of emotion. I want you to understand this very clearly, Rita. The history of dealings between the clan and the U.S. government is toxic. You must be clear with your superiors. We are not the clan. The clan tore itself apart after the family trade people stuck their oar into Grunmarked politics by nuking the Hjalmar Palace, which they did before 716. I'm not going to get into tit-for-tat or recriminations here. What happened, happened. The world walkers here in the Commonwealth are refugees. We earn our keep as far as the Commonwealth government is concerned, but we don't set policy. Olga cleared her throat. We mostly don't set policy, Mrs. Burgesson amended. But here's the thing. The very first time the United States made contact with another timeline, it ended in a nuclear holocaust. I want you to tell your superiors that it had better not happen again. My superior, the first man, the head of state, is of the opinion that the least bad strategy to pursue is one called mutually assured destruction. It's an old Cold War trade-off. Both sides know that if they launch a preemptive attack, they will destroy their enemy, but only at the cost of being destroyed themselves. The new American Commonwealth has an arsenal containing more than 9,000 hydrogen bombs, because we are locked in a Cold War standoff with the French Empire. More than 1,000 of those weapons, her voice wavered, are targeted on U.S. cities right now. God knows we don't want to use them, but if we are attacked, retaliation is certain to follow.
You're...
Rita boggled at her.
That's insane.
Tell me about it. Mrs. Burgesson smiled weakly. Which is why that letter is so important. It's an invitation to discuss the ground rules for diplomatic engagement, so we can find a way to step back from the brink, before some idiot on either side starts World War IV by accident. Olga cleared her throat. Oh, yes. Mrs. Burgesson was weaving the shreds of her dignity into a cloak of confidence, collecting herself visibly from second to second. Of course, this has to happen at the worst possible time. Rita, the other thing your bosses need to know is that the first man, Adam Burrows, has terminal cancer.
So there's going to be an election soon? Rita asked. Or does he have a vice president?
The evil queen shook her head. It doesn't work that way. The Commonwealth is only 17 years old. They had a revolution, and before that it was an absolute monarchy. Think North Korea, not Disney. The Commonwealth's constitution is only 15 years old, and it has never been tested by a peaceful transfer of leadership. Adam has been the first man since the very beginning. In theory, we know what's supposed to happen and how to do it. In practice,
nobody knows, Olga said darkly.
Most likely there will be a peaceful transfer of power to the new first man, or perhaps even a first woman. But that's far from certain. Mrs. Burgesson picked up the narrative. The point is, we have weeks, not months, to sort out an agreement that cools everything down. If we don't get there while the first man is well enough to sign off on it, everything goes back to square one, only in the middle of a succession crisis. Which is really risky, because war planners love to take advantage of succession crises, never mind the fact that one possible outcome is that our own hardliners could end up running the show. She met Rita's eyes, and Rita froze. She felt as if the evil queen could see right through her, and for a sickening moment she wondered if she'd fallen into the wrong fairy tale by mistake. But we're out of time now. You'd better be going before the specials arrive with an arrest warrant. If you change your mind, if you want answers, I'll be here for you. Goodbye, Rita. Phoenix. Timeline 2, August 2020.
Another morning. Kurt Douglas yawned as he shuffled around the kitchen. His feet, back, knees, and hips ached. The kettle on the stovetop was beginning to steam as he added coffee grounds to a filter cone, measuring them carefully. 2.5 precisely heaped spoonfuls was his habit. He had a rigid idea of how best to greet a new day. He would brew his coffee, then he would retreat to the downstairs bathroom to take his morning medication, shave, and read the news on his tablet while he threw off the early morning lassitude. He'd had a disturbed night's sleep, as was increasingly normal for him these years, and he rattled around this huge 2/3 empty house like a dried pea in a toothless mouth. The sheer distance from bed to bathroom was a nuisance, forcing him to fully awaken when he had to rise in the small hours to deal with his old man's bladder. If Greta had been around, she could have helped him fill the house. But as things stood, he almost resented its size. Franz expected him to keep the place proudly, like a janitor in a palace that his grandchildren would inherit in due course. Collecting his coffee, he retreated into the comfort of his morning routine. Everything was much the same as any other day, until he came to his email. A letter from Rita. He read it with increasing engagement, looking for the little signs between the written words. So, she had run into a special friend? Or a friend, anyway? One of the girls from back when they'd lived on the East Coast. His brow wrinkled unconsciously. Interesting. Of course, Rita knew better than to use email for anything important. What was the girl trying to tell him? Oh, of course. Kurt did not hurry his routine, but when half an hour later he dressed in sweatpants and shirt and sports sandals and walked slowly across to his son's mailbox, he was unsurprised to find a letter within, addressed by hand to K. Douglas, laboriously and in unpracticed capitals. Someone unused to writing longhand, someone young, or at least young by Kurt's standards. His pulse quickened, but he refrained from deviating from his routine in any way. He carried the post into Franz and Emily's house, sorting the other items into two neat piles and placing them on the breakfast bar. Only after the normal delay did he go home, with the envelope concealed under his shirt. Once inside, Kurt locked the door and shuffled upstairs to the spare bedroom he sometimes used as a study. He drew the curtains, then turned on a portable camping lantern for illumination. He placed it on the small desk beside the letter, and a battered paperback, and some writing materials. He pulled on a pair of disposable latex gloves, careful not to touch their exterior. Then he sat down and pulled a blanket over his head, forming a tent above desk, lamp, and letter. It was no guarantee that he was free from observation, but unless the observers in question had glued a webcam to his forehead while he slept, one small enough that he had missed it in the bathroom mirror while shaving, it was fairly certain that they had no direct knowledge of the letter's contents. Unless it had been open and scanned and resealed in transit, even though it had been addressed to another. But that way lay madness. It was a letter, an old-fashioned handwritten missive, directed to him by name. Dear Mr. Douglas, your granddaughter Rita said I should write to you. I've been reading the book you gave her, and I have some questions you might help me with for my comprehension class. Kurt suppressed the impulse to nod approvingly. The code words were in place, falling in their assigned word order like pins between a key's serrated teeth, ready to unlock hidden wisdom. One of the youngsters, a little cub, nosing up to the pack leader for advice. He turned to his copy of the book and began to draw the grid for the one-time pad. The questions were a neat block, written painstakingly in a crabbed hand that bespoke focus and paranoia. Rita, in DHS, stop. Urgently need support, stop. Can orchestra contact birth mother? Ends. Kurt grunted painfully. For a moment he felt despair. He'd been afraid of this, or something like this, for many years. It was not just the very specific fear that something might reach out from the dark heart of the security state and snatch away his granddaughter, who, for all that she bore none of his genes, thought more like him than his own son. It was the broader, agoraphobic fear that the unquiet dead were stirring in their graves, a third of a century after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was impossible to outrun memory, or to outlive one's sins. As long as the Wolf Orchestra remained hidden, abandoned in place by the state it served when the Cold War ended and the German Democratic Republic ceased to exist, the temptation to awaken the musicians was there. He could summon them to their instruments and play a last devilish ditty, tempting and taunting those who knew. Kurt had remembered, and silently practiced the necessary rituals for all the years of their exile. For more than 3 decades, he'd let them lie, trusting that save for the annual ritual of the greeting cards, to keep track of his players, he could allow his conductor's baton to gather dust. But now another hand had reached out. This Angie, Rita's friend. Angie Hagen, Alex Hagen's granddaughter, another of the third-generation children, born and raised on American soil. Children trained by their parents and grandparents to serve the fatherland, whether they knew it or not. "I could try to do this on my own," he thought dubiously. Why disturb his musician's beauty sleep? Many of the first generation were dead of old age. Some of them were senile, disturbing their fellow nursing home inmates with the black comedy of their memories, dismissed as demented confabulators by children and carers alike as they randomly blabbed state secrets over the dinner table. Most of the active ones today were children or grandchildren, born and educated here like the descendants of conversos, Jews living under suspicion as Catholic converts after the reconquest of Spain. They kept to the rituals of their parents out of habit, living in constant fear of the Inquisition's knock on the door. Few of them were truly aware of what they had once been expected to do, and fewer still were ideologically committed. The inner citadel of belief in the workers' duty to build a paradise on earth had been betrayed by history. They'd been misled by their own leaders and teachers, then abandoned in the dark abyss of late-stage capitalism. Nobody really believed anymore, but it was still too dangerous to contemplate reconciliation with the nation in which they were embedded like a fragment of shrapnel from an unremembered Cold War explosion. "The bastards have Rita," Kurt reminded himself. They had stolen her, and they would use her until she broke, for they knew her to be of enemy breeding, even if she herself did not. His resolve hardened. "I will visit this angel," he decided. She cared enough for Rita that she'd written a coded plea to the orchestra conductor. "Philadelphia? It's been a long time." He'd visited the city of brotherly love once before. It would be interesting to see how it had changed. He would talk to Rita's angel, and then he would commence the search for Rita's birth mother. But he would not do so unaided. First, there were notes to be written and sent, anonymous letters to the neighbors of his sleeping agents, letters containing signs and code words to remind them of the faith they once held, before the great betrayal and the Wiedervereinigung of 1990. Words to awaken them and call them to the flag, words of action saying, "Stand by." They, or their parents or grandparents, had been loyal members of the Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung,
the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Stasi, once upon a time. They'd been sent to these alien American shores to await an unspecified future mission. They were the members of the Wolf Orchestra, the last and greatest communist sleeper ring, injected into the United States between the 1960s and the 1980s by order of the chief spymaster of the GDR, Marcus Wolf himself. Comrade Wolf was long dead of old age, and the nation he had served was itself liquidated almost a third of a century ago, its ideology bankrupt and its walls smashed. The Stasi's foreign files had burned before the capitalists, flush from their triumph over the Democratic Republic, could retrieve them. The members of the orchestra were stranded on foreign soil as aimless illegals, unable to return home despite, or because of, the end of their mission. But if they and their descendants held the faith, faith in each other, never mind the failed dream of a workers' state, they would surely come to his aid when he called. And so Kurt Douglas allowed himself to be goaded into action by Rita's guardian angel, unreasonably angered at the bumbling conscription of his granddaughter by the amateurs and clowns who passed for spies in today's America, and raised his baton to summon the Wolf Orchestra back to life to play the Cold War blues one last time.